I love you, Marjorie.
Oh, Homer. I love you, too.
I have...
Current geek!
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Current Geek Autopilot Edition. Chance for us to go back and watch the pilot episode of an old classic slash geeky TV show. Talk about how it differed from the rest of the series, or what we remember about the show in general. I'm Scott Johnson, he's Tom Merritt, and this week, we're talking about The Simpsons.
Oh my, yes. And like many pilots, there are things to talk about regarding just what the pilot actually is. Sometimes, in fact, recently on Current Geek Autopilot Editions, we've had pilots that were pretty straightforward. It was the first episode that aired. It was the first episode that was made. Even most of the cast was the same, etc. Simpsons has a controversial story behind its pilot, does it not?
Yeah, surprisingly so. I didn't expect any of that stuff. Didn't know about it either. There's like a if you guys like Firefly and you thought, man, that pilot sure felt weird and out of place, we have another one of those for you. I'm not sure it feels weird and out of place in this case, but...
Well, yeah, it's the pilot of Firefly didn't air until like partway through the season. They didn't air it as the first episode. Mm-hmm. So you didn't get the setup of Firefly until later on. With The Simpsons, there's not so much of a story setup in the first episode, but there are some other differences. I don't know if you went and watched Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire, which was the first episode that aired, but you can already see differences between that episode and the first episode, which the pilot, we should probably explain everything about it, didn't air until the very end of the first season.
Right.
So you get this sort of them perfecting how to do the show, and then the last episode of the season is this really rough episode because... well, first of all, I guess we should point out that The Simpsons were shorts that were showed in the Tracy Ullman show starting on April 19th, 1987. And if you go back and look at those Simpsons are weird.
They're super weird and they're great. Like, I love that stuff. It was my first, for a lot of us, our first introduction to those. And I remember thinking, ooh, I can't wait for these. It got to the point where I was less interested in what Tracy Ullman was doing between them and more interested in what these shorts were about.
Yeah.
Because they were
I was the same way. I have fond memories of going over to my sister's house in 1987 and sitting and watching Tracy Ullman's show. And we would talk through most of the show until the Simpsons parts came on. And then we'd stop and be like, oh, gotta watch.
Yeah. And at the time, it was so new and subversive and weird. There wasn't any kind of like edgy, stuff like that, animated stuff like that on TV, really. And I was starting to get a taste of it in things like Liquid Television, which was more hitting its stride in the 90s and not so much the 80s, but you were about to have this little revolution of strange animation. I used to go to animation festivals, and these things were full of weirdness, and so this felt like a part of that, and it really did feel like you were seeing something new and different, and I didn't know a lot about Groening's work. I didn't know a lot about Life in Hell or his other projects before this, so to me, this was just brand new brand of weirdness that felt special and like it was going to go someplace, and you didn't know how or why or what, but you just knew there was more to this than what we were getting in these little 5 second or 5 minute chunks or less. I guess it was more.
Well,
like,
and originally what they wanted Groening to do for Tracy Ullman's show was Life in Hell. They're like, can you animate your characters from Life in Hell? Because it was starting to, that cartoon was starting to catch on in popularity. It was in the era of Bloom County, etc. And Groening realized that if he did that, he would have to give up some rights because, to get on TV, you have to give up rights to animation, et cetera. And he didn't want to give up rights to his babies.
Right.
So he created all new characters and pitched that and said, and the story goes, he was waiting to go into the pitch meeting.
Right.
And he sketched out really quickly his dad, his mom, his sister, and himself. And gave them their names. His dad's name, Homer. His mom's name, Marge. His sister's name, Lisa. He changed his name from Matt to Bart, which was an anagram for brat, and pitched the idea of a dysfunctional family, sort of based on his own family.
Right. Like, can you imagine being at your big meeting and you're prepared to give away what you think is your property that you would never want to give away? And maybe still feels that way. I don't know. It'd be interesting to talk to him now about that. Because does he still?
Well, because The Simpsons are way more well known than Life in Hell. Life in Hell has persisted, but it's always been on the back burner behind not only The Simpsons, but Futurama. And I don't know if Disenchanted is getting all of that.
I like Disenchanted. Buzz, I think, yeah. I may be weird, but I think Disenchanted is kind of cool. But here's the thing with that, though. Early on in those days, he's an independent comic book creator. Like, that's his main gig. And that ilk of artist is known to be, and part of this is because I just got back from the Comic Museum in Columbus, Ohio, so I have this, I have a kind of an attitude right now about this, but he was like a lot of those guys, especially in that era, very protective of his work and did not feel good about just letting it flip around willy-nilly. And so his decision to do that last minute turned out to be a really fateful one, because we're now celebrating 30 years as of Sunday, with a brand new episode of the 30th season, 30 years of The Simpsons.
Wow.
And we could have the big, I mean, Tom, we could have the big long talks about whether The Simpsons is still good or not. We had I had a whole episode of Unfriend Me with Justin about this very thing. Is it still good or isn't it? And
you know, my personal story with The Simpsons, of course, started with watching it on the Tracy Ullman show, was a devoted follower for the first several seasons, kind of drifted away, and then came back like late 90s, early 2000s. I started watching it again and then drifted back away again. Mm-hmm. So I feel like The Simpsons is sort of a consistent pool that is fun to watch or not, depending on where you are and what your needs are in your life. It doesn't grow with you, though, just like the characters never grow up. And flashbacks and flash forwards are always relative to the season you're watching. There's no consistency to the backstory. It just sort of floats along.
Yeah. And it's a very much a sort of thing of the week sort of approach to television. Futurama was that, but also had a, you know, continuous thread of story, Fry stuck in the future, blah, 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 and all that connected to that. And Disenchanted is even more linear and more overarching story, less weird thing of the week. And I think that's because they're also on a streaming platform that's all about binging, so it's probably better presented as one long big story, multiple episodes. But The Simpsons still stands as certainly the most influential, one of the most influential comedies, let alone animated comedies of all time. In fact, up until then, there really were, we hadn't gotten back around to making primetime animation, and especially primetime animation that wasn't afraid to drop a few hells and dams and be a little rude with its humor. Like this,
and
this
certainly Bart, I mean, we think of Bart Simpson as kind of tame these days, but back in the late 80s, Bart Simpson was controversial. He was a bad role model for kids and disrespected his parents. And what a horrible character to put in a cartoon primetime television.
This was the problem, is they thought the culture at large thought cartoons were for kids.
Right.
And they've had this in their head since the beginning of time. And the only place where that culture shifted in a meaningful way early was in Japan. They very quickly went, this is a medium for everybody. There's stuff for kids. There's stuff for adults. There's stuff all in between. So we've just been slow to do that. I think we're still slow to do it. And in the 80s and in the 90s, when a cartoon would be like this, or when The Simpsons was in its heyday, you know, your mothers and your pearl clutchers would see this and say, oh, how can they do this cartoon? Because they just assume that if it's a cartoon, it's for kids. Otherwise, it would be live action and be for adults. And I fought with people about this all the time, because I knew what they were doing. They were subverting that cultural expectation that animation was just for kids, and it's not, and it never was, and it never will be. And we've come a long way, but I was always really pro this, and I appreciate The Simpsons blazing that trail. It's funny, because in some ways they're like super subversive and, you know, stick it to the man and all of that. And on the other hand, they're incredibly commercially successful.
Yeah.
And now is old. It's old. 30 years is a long time.
It's safe.
Yeah.
Bob's Burgers is edgier than The Simpsons.
Yes. But then you could say,
not that Bob's Burgers is all that edgy, but, you know, I'm just saying.
But you could be in a debate about whether Bob's Burgers even exists in a non-Simpsons world, and you could argue that it doesn't. So, you know, there's so much. What 30 years gives you is just so many angles on a show that has been that impactful and still retains a sizable audience and still retains popularity. Now in the world of the internet, a whole lot of arguing goes on about whether it was good or when it was good or whether it got better.
Eh. See what I did?
Yeah, I see what you did. You already did it. Yeah, you've done. Yeah. You've proved my point. So I like that. I think that it's still controversial in whatever ways it wants to be. I will just get it out now so people don't wonder in the whole episode how Scott feels, and you can perhaps express your feelings as well. But I never tired of it. I like it then, again, now, and in reruns. I think it's all
funny.
I'll
be honest, I haven't watched a new episode in years. I don't know if I would like it or not, but I don't dislike it. Yeah. It's not like the last episode I saw, I went, oh, it's so bad now. It just felt the same. It's like, oh, that's The Simpsons. I know what I'm getting.
Yeah. In fact, you could argue it feels less good in this first season, certainly in this weird end of season was supposed to be the pilot business. Is pretty rough around the edges. And I don't just mean technically. Certainly were technical reasons.
Let's talk a little bit about that. The first episode that aired of The Simpsons was Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire. It was billed as a Christmas special. It aired December 17th, 1989. And then in January, they resumed with non-Christmas episodes. Mm-hmm. But it was supposed to premiere in the fall. It was supposed to be a fall premiere with the episode Some Enchanted Evening. Now, that episode did air. It aired May 13th, 1990. So it aired at the very end of season one. But the reason it was delayed in premiering and the reason Some Enchanted Evening wasn't premiered until the end of the season is it was bad animation. Mm. They had written a script. They recorded the voices. They sent it off for animation. And what they got back, they thought they were going to fix things. Matt Groening was new to this, I guess, and didn't realize that they just took what he gave them and filled in the fill frames. And that was it. So you have like people getting bloated and then turning skinny within the same scenes. You have like some really, really like jerky animation. The only thing I've seen of the actual pilot is the 5 minutes they put on as a DVD extra years ago. But they give you examples of multiple parts of that episode. It's not just like the first 5 minutes. And if you compare that to what eventually aired, you'll note that there's a few things that changed in the story where they tightened things up, but by and large, it's the same VO that was done originally, but the animation is entirely different.
Yeah.
The animation, while still not up to what you would expect when you look at season 30, is much improved over that pilot episode that they first delivered. So it's probably a good thing that delayed it, because it would have gotten bashed by people who know animation, and that couldn't have helped it.
Right. Also, that's a very interesting point, because TV had not been known for good animation quality for a very long time, at least not in the medium. That was reserved for film, because that's where the budgets were and the idea of less frames.
Disney was short. The king and queen and non-gendered monarch of animation.
Sure. And I would argue, again, this is another thing I think The Simpsons gave us, or at least pioneered, was it's okay to be a little stiff, a little weird, a little whatever. In fact, it's better to be a little weird and have it feel kind of off in a strange way. These people are all yellow and they're kind of funky looking, and definitely Groening's style was there, but a lot of people didn't know his style. They don't know Life in Hell. That's a very obscure thing. So to them, this just looked very strange compared to what they were used to on Saturday morning cartoons. And now we are buried in animation these days. It's kind of a golden age where those lessons, or I guess those techniques, are still there. I was watching King of the Hill, which is kind of a contemporary of The Simpsons, but also a little bit, it started later. But again, probably a thing that Mike Judge would have never gotten off the ground had it not been for The Simpsons and what trail it blazed. And I'm watching that and going, this is bad looking, but to its credit, like, it works for what the story and the characters are. It isn't a problem. And The Simpsons had the same thing. It wasn't a problem for The Simpsons to have it look a little janky. And now I think there are cartoons that are on the air right now that are intentionally not bad looking, but have a certain aesthetic.
Yeah, they pick a rough aesthetic.
There you go. And it's even done, a lot of it's done with automated, a lot of automation with computers and stuff. People are using, Toon Boom Studio and these sorts of things to make full stuff. Rick and Morty's a good example. It's weird, it's janky, it's bloody, it's splashy, it's strange. And it's on purpose. And it's also very digitally handled. Still a lot of people involved. But the point is that as digital technology's gotten better, it isn't like they all got away from that jank. They decided to stay within that aesthetic. And I think that's, again, to the credit of things like The Simpsons, sort of establishing early this idea that it could be rough and it could be rough on purpose. And that was not only acceptable, but maybe even more than acceptable. Like, that's actually what you want out of this.
In fact, when you look at the 5 minutes of the original pilot, there's a part of me that says, well, that just looks like what was on Tracy Ullman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bart's head was never properly proportioned in any of the Tracy Ullman shorts.
No.
There were definitely that sort of like weight gain and loss as they moved sort of situation. And maybe, you know, maybe Groening thought they would fix it in post-production, or maybe he was like, no, I mean, it worked with Tracy Ullman fine. Let's keep going with it. But there is something rougher about the cut than even the Tracy Ullman stuff. And maybe it's because the Tracy Ullman stuff is shorts, so it doesn't stick with you as long, but the long scene around breakfast just really feels weird pacing. And granted, the DVD extra doesn't include sound effects. It doesn't include music. It just includes the voice track. So that makes it feel a little weirder too.
Yeah.
But when you compare it to what actually ended up airing, you're like, well, yeah, that still has that graining roughness, but doesn't fluctuate. It doesn't look like it's, you know, they sort of remind me of those things you put out at the auto dealer that just get blown in the wind and kind of shake their arms. That's how the pilot feels before they fixed it.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. What are those called? Those are called something.
I'm sure they have a name. I don't know what it is.
Wind monkeys. No?
Yes, that's what we will call them from now on.
All right.
Wind monkeys.
Wind monkeys it is.
Long may they wave.
Yeah. No, that's true. And I would say if I had any criticism about the more current versions of the show, and I do watch new ones on Hulu when they come out. The whole family does. We've been fans forever, and we still are. If I only had one complaint, there is maybe it's just because I know better now, but there is a polishedness to it that is like, it's like they took the original rough concepts and over all these many, many, many seasons, it's impossible probably not to do this, but after all these many seasons, they've got it to a science. It's just working the way it's supposed to. And some see that as a negative. I even see it as a bit of a negative, but there's another positive spin on that, which is the workflow that they created with The Simpsons became the template for everybody doing animation, primetime or otherwise. And that being outsourcing to Korea, that entire industry boomed because of The Simpsons. And you could even say exists because of The Simpsons and now flourishes because of everything else. That's a great working relationship for a lot of producers here and around the world, working with Korean animators and the like, as one example. But the workflow around putting together quality animated content quickly and inexpensively without losing creative vision, like all of that stuff is kind of new in this 30-year time frame. There really wasn't a template for it before this. The template before this was things like the Flintstones and the Jetsons, which were basically the same show, just set in two different...
And those were sort of the last successful primetime animations. There were a few others after that that weren't nearly as popular, but Flintstones and Jetsons, I think people forget, were primetime animation shows.
Yeah, and they were some of the last. There was some pretty great stuff happening with Rocky and Bullwinkle. But again, those were not necessarily geared for primetime. They were, however, adult themes and issues and jokes sometimes carefully disguised as children's entertainment. And he, Matt Groening, has gone, I've heard him in various interviews giving huge credit to the Rocky and Bullwinkle show for being this, you know, impetus for a lot of this stuff. A lot of people do. That stuff was really edgy at the time and really cool in the early 70s. But at, you know, the state of it all now, it's just sort of a demarcation line. It's Simpsons before and Simpsons after. And again, it's hard for me, no matter how I feel about the quality of it or whether you're just tired of it or or whatever, you can't deny the impact. And I don't just mean commercially. Like, it changed the landscape of that stuff and made primetime animation that tackled subjects that were outside the range of a 7-year-old. Nothing wrong with all that stuff. Keep it. Let's have more of that too. But, you know, I don't think that can be understated. It's huge.
Yep. The Simpsons is the longest running American sitcom. Forget animated.
Yeah.
You don't even have to use the word animated in any of this. Longest running American sitcom and the longest running American scripted primetime television series in terms of seasons and number of episodes. There was a point in the early 2000s where it passed Gunsmoke.
Gunsmoke at 20 or something, right?
Yeah. But it didn't pass it in episode number. It passed it in seasons.
Oh.
Because Gunsmoke had done more episodes per season. Then right. Eventually it passed it in episodes as well. Mm. There was also another series that came back at one point and passed The Simpsons again. And Simpsons had to catch up and pass it. But again, that was 15 years ago.
Sure.
The Simpsons is the longest running American scripted primetime television series. And the reason it's phrased that way is, there are longer news programs. There are longer running soap operas.
Mm.
So it's prime time and scripted.
Right. That combination. Yeah. Whereas daytime TV, while scripted, is not prime time and is kind of in its own category. In fact, it has its own awards. So they don't even talk about them in the Emmys. And then you got your news programs like, you know, NBC Nightly News.
Yeah,
or whatever.
This Week and all
yeah,
of that.
All that stuff's yeah, going to be longer. But if you're talking about, you know, TV show the way we think of TV shows, a story, right. Characters,
your
whatever.
Primetime TV show.
This is it, man. And in a way, I can't help but think, but I mean, obviously it's been a profitable enterprise, or they wouldn't do it so long. But also it does feel like they're sort of saying, well, we're going to have the all-time record come hell or high water. There's never going to be anything close to this. And they're kind of every season that airs, it's like a new shoring up of that commitment that this will be the longest running thing ever. And some see that as a problem because you're just going to run it into the ground in their mind. And why would you do that to something that does have, you know, a lot of nostalgia for a lot of people? I kind of can see their point there, but I always take issue with people who came of age either during or after the middle of the Simpsons initial, let's say 10 or 15 years. Mm-hmm. Those guys usually are ones that have a lot of hate. And I was 19 when I saw it. That's when The Simpsons started. I was 19 years old. And I feel like everything I've seen from The Simpsons from then till today, I have seen as an adult, more or less. Certainly as a voting adult. And if you were 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 when you saw The Simpsons and loved it, and then you just went through puberty and became a teenager and went through that whole life change, and didn't like The Simpsons on the other side, I feel like it's more informed by their life experience than it is about the quality of the show. So I'm just going to put that out there because a lot of people don't like this argument, but I'm making it. I think that's on you guys for growing up during the wrong time.
Well, okay. I think you lose people when you put it that way. It's on, like, it's your fault
because
that makes people defensive. Like, well, it's not my fault for growing up. Was I not supposed to go through puberty? Come on.
Yeah.
But I think where your point is well made is you are the one who changed, not The Simpsons.
Right. You're right.
And so it's not that The Simpsons got bad. It's that your taste changed. Mm-hmm. And your perceptions changed. You changed. And that's fine. You had to grow up. But don't blame The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Like, you know, some people grow up and still find it funny and love it. And some people are like me and are like, oh, yeah, no, that's great. Not the thing I need anymore, but it served me well once and I'll always love it for that. And then there's other people like, I hate it now.
Yeah.
You know, what I loved about it when I was 8 doesn't work for me anymore because I'm 25. And that's fair. That's fine. Right. There's nothing wrong with that. Doesn't mean The Simpsons is bad, though.
Right.
It just means you changed and there's, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. And it's an objective thing regardless. But it's like when you're in junior high and you buy Chumbawamba because you think that's the greatest album of all time.
Yeah.
And then... And then later you go, oh, I'm 17 or 18 now. I don't like Chumbawamba at all. Like, it's a little like that. I'm not saying that Simpsons was always like Chumbawamba. It's a bad example in that regard. But But there's those things you do in your life. You think something's super cool as a kid.
I believe Homer has sung Chumbawamba.
He probably has.
In an episode of The Simpsons at some point.
This is all probably true.
He had a whiskey drink. He had a vodka drink.
Wow. Hold on. Your familiarity with Chumbawamba in such short notice is a little troublesome. Yeah.
Well, and I think Chumbawamba is a great idea because people are like, Chumbawamba should never be played anymore. Chumbawamba should no longer be heard. Like, okay, fine. Don't play it. Mm. Same with The Simpsons. You don't like it? Don't watch it.
Yeah.
Don't take it away from the people who still like it. You know, they're like, Simpsons should be killed. It should be canceled. It's a travesty that they're still making it. Well, if people are still enjoying it, mm-hmm. why would you do that to them?
Yeah. I don't understand
that.
Just
don't watch it. It's fine. It's not hurting anybody for you not to watch it.
No. Yeah. Don't kill it on just because you don't like it. I mean, there is a feeling that it's objectively bad in a lot of people's minds, and I can't really have even conversations with them, but
yeah. But even if it was objectively bad and some people liked it and you're like, they're wrong for liking it, they still like it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Some people like, I don't know, cream corn. And so should we ban cream corn because you don't like it and it's objectively bad? Why? You know, if people want to buy cream corn, let them eat it. People want to watch Simpsons, let them watch it.
People, I feel like it's a microcosm of what become the great divide that we now see sometimes on the internet where people have really put themselves on a hill to die on when it comes to certain fandoms. And The Simpsons is a early example of it, for sure.
I love being on a hill to die on in defense of my fandom. Mm. I love being on the hill to die on when it's like, this is why Firefly is amazing. What I don't love is being on a hill to die on to stop someone else from enjoying something they like. Like, that's no, why is that fun? Why is that important? Yeah. Let them enjoy it. They're not bothering you.
That's true.
Unless they're trying to force you to like their thing, that's a whole different thing. But if they're just often doing their thing and enjoying it, why are you trying to stop them? Stay out of their life.
Yeah. I also, I couldn't stop thinking during this viewing about what would come later. And what would come later is one of my favorite shows of all time, Futurama.
I love Futurama.
Yeah, and yeah. I think about it sometimes about what was my attitude when Futurama started? How did that evolve? How did I feel toward the end? And how do I feel now? And it's interesting. Futurama, I remember when I went into Futurama for the first time, I came out with a little bit of a, I don't know, what is that? This isn't what I don't know what this is. Like it's so different from The Simpsons and not at the same time, right? Very mm-hmm. visually similar. Obviously, it's a graining creation, and some of your voice actors are back, and there's some similarities, but also a bunch of new people. I don't know who Billy West was at the time. I figured out later he was also Stimpy, but, you know, at first I didn't know. And yeah. there were things like that that made me just, not uncomfortable, but like, I don't know if I like this. And then I kept going, and then I became, oh, wait, no, it's not that I don't like it. It's that I love this. And then, oh, my gosh, I love this so much. This better never go away. And when it did go away, I went, no. And then when it came back, I went, yes. And then when it went away again, I went, no. And then the movies, yes. Like, I was having this up-and-down relationship with it because I was always so stoked if they were going to do anything else with it. I would just, and I'd do it now. If you told me tomorrow a new video game's come out, I'd be, oh, well, I got to get it. Like, I'd freak out. And I'm having the same experience with Enchanted, or Disenchanted, rather. Is it Disenchanted or Disenchanted?
Disenchanted, yeah.
Not Chantment, right? Chanted. No. Anyway, I started watching it and went, oh, this is not like Futurama. This is something else. I don't know if I like it yet. And then it got its hooks in me. And by the time I was done with that season, I really liked Disenchanted, like a lot.
Disenchantment. You were right.
Yes, meant.
Enchantment.
Disenchantment. Yes. And what I like about it partially is that it's not trying to be the exact same thing. That's also dangerous for him mm-hmm. to make mm-hmm. projects where they demarcate themselves away from those other two landmark shows. One of the advantages that Futurama has is that it ended, and it ended twice technically, but the fact that it ended meant we don't have to in 30 years talk about whether it got bad or not, you know? And so The Simpsons has this like scarlet letter around its neck that says, we never ended, therefore it's going to be easy to say we suck because nobody should last this long. You know what I mean? Like it's a can't win no matter what you do if you're a show that's that old.
Whereas I'm offended that you're still being made.
But in Futurama's case, we can always celebrate it because it stopped, and part of us are mad that it stopped. I mean, it's like we're humans are weird what we want.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if you ask me right now, Scott, and what do you want? I want more.
It's fine to have an opinion about whether you think Simpsons is good or not anymore. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with you saying I hate the Simpsons. It's when you want it to not be made for the people who like it that I'm like, so just don't watch it.
Yeah.
You don't have to. There's no law that says you have to watch it.
Right. You can avoid it completely. In fact, I assume that they are, because no one I ever talked to, you know, if they say, The Simpsons is terrible, how can you watch it? And I'll say, when's the last time you saw it? Season 8. I'm like, okay, well, we can't have a conversation. We can't even talk. Like, how can we even talk about this? Because you don't even know what I'm referring to. You haven't seen one in that long. Are there duds in there? Yes, I could point them out to you.
There were in the first 8 seasons, too.
Yeah, I would argue this one that we watched today might be a bit of a dud. I don't think it's great.
Let's talk about this. This actual episode. Did you get a chance to rewatch Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire as
No,
well,
I didn't have time because I just got home from this trip last night, but I'm still planning on seeing that so I can get the comparison.
I just rewatched it, and if you've seen it, it's so memorable because it's the first time you meet Mr. Burns, it's the first time you meet Selma and Patty, it's the first time you meet the dog, obviously. Spoiler, that's the end. They get the dog.
Mm-hmm.
So it's iconic, and I've probably seen it. I don't know. I've probably seen it 20 times, you know, so it's super memorable, but it also feels very modern. Whereas Some Enchanted Evening very much feels like a pilot.
Yep.
You only see Mo and Barney as the extended characters that are going to be around more. I think that radio DJ guy shows up as a different guy. He's not always a radio DJ, but as far as iconic characters, Mo and Barney are it. It's a very much a one-track story. Voice-wise, all of them were a little different in the Tracy Ullman show than they became on the show.
Yeah.
But man, Homer is not the same. And the Christmas special, he definitely sounds a lot more like the modern Homer than he does in Some Enchanted Evening. Some Enchanted Evening, he sounds like a dad.
Hello, everybody.
He doesn't
Homer.
Sound like Homer, you know? Not that my Homer's any good, but, you know.
Right. Yeah, it changed a lot. In fact, here's one of the funnier jokes, and this is Homer's voice, so you guys can hear what Tom's talking about. Very different than the current incarnation of Dan Castellaneta's, how do you say his name? Lanetta's Castellaneta.
Castanets.
Thank you. Castanets is correct.
I'm sure he never gets that one.
This is him well before he had that ironed out, so here you go.
Another bottle of your second least expensive champagne.
Yeah, just not what it is today. It's just a
you
different voice.
You can hear Homer in the voice, but it's like someone is not quite doing Homer.
it's like a bad impression of Homer or something.
Yeah.
But this is true. Like, watch any animated show, and it's always this way first 2 seasons or so.
Yeah.
Family Guy was this way. Everybody sounds real weird in that. Bob's Burgers, even a more modern example, which, by the way, just hit, 9 seasons?
I know. I can't believe that.
Really fast. But if you go back and watch the pilot, you'll be shocked at how subdued a bunch of people are. Or even a live action thing. Go watch the pilot episode of Arrested Development, and Ron Howard, who's narrating, is half asleep in that thing, whereas later he's got like a cadence to him, but in that beginning it wasn't there yet. So, you know, this stuff takes time. I am 100% cool with that, no problem with it. But the idea that they had it all figured out in that first season is kind of crazy. I think The Simpsons really hit its stride like season 3, 4, somewhere in that range, where you were like, okay, this is a cultural icon. This is a thing that informs, you know, your weekly viewing habits. Like, this is a big deal. But that early stuff, just like you would expect, is a little rough around those edges.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because Homer, not only voice feels weird, but he feels angry.
Yeah.
He feels like an angry dad. And I feel like, I don't really know if this is true, but I feel like he's more like Matt Groening's actual dad than Homer Simpson. I think he becomes more lovable over the years because he's very stern and angry. And, you know, he walks out the door without kissing Marge. And, you know, it's just... It always has felt like a 50s family, not a 80s family, 90s family, or even a modern day family. But it feels extra so in this episode. Lisa and Marge aren't necessarily acting in ways that are different than they will be, but they're not fully there.
Mm.
You don't get Lisa really, like, it's not till the Christmas episode that she says something well beyond her ears to Patty and Selma, and that they brush off. In Some Enchanted Evening, she's just sort of like the more grounded one who but really gets excited about the elf show. Whereas Bart feels like Bart. Like, this is Bart all the way through to, you know, I would imagine today. Like, he hasn't changed a bit.
Yeah, I agree. A voice a little bit, but not much. And
not a lot. Yeah.
Attitude wise, it's absolutely Bart. And Lisa, you know, Lisa would later become this voice of reason, of social action, of, you know, she represented the sort of progressive, smart, let's go to college, let's change the world, let's save the seals sort of thing that she became, which is great. Her arc, I think Lisa's arc is great. But in this episode, you get none of that, really. It's just she's a little bit more cautious than Bart about the prank calls or something that they're doing. And a really weird B story. Like, the A story is Marge and Homer need to rekindle their marriage. So they go to a fancy dinner, and Homer orders the second least expensive wine on the menu, and they're dancing, and they're all doing this. And in the meantime, this Mrs. Potts, or whatever her name is, was hired last second to be the babysitter for the kids. And it turns out she's some kidnapper slash who knows. I mean, they didn't really get into what her crimes were.
Well, she's the babysitter bandit.
Yeah.
So she agrees to be a babysitter, and then she robs the people that she's babysitting.
That's the deal. And she has two big suitcases full of like tools and stuff to break into things, and or at least presumably we didn't.
Well,
really,
she has suitcases that she fills with all the stuff she's stealing.
Right. They're for some reason though, when she came in, they were full, and that part I couldn't figure that out. That's why I thought they were just tools or something. Because why would you bring the loot from the last place? I don't know. It was weird. Anyway, then she's chasing the kids around. They're hiding. They're calling 911. They're trying to, you know, it basically becomes this sort of hand that rocks the cradle kind of sub story. And it was an interesting look at the idea that The Simpsons would make this a staple of their storytelling. They would always kind of move forward with A and Bs, but this seemed so forced in there. It's hard to explain why, but it just didn't feel right to me to have them out having this party, and at home the kids are getting chased by a psycho. For some reason, it just felt like that was not given enough time to flesh either side out in 20 minutes. So
no, exactly. It's when The Simpsons is great, it's being absurd. Mm-hmm. It's taking you in directions that not even just that you can't predict, but directions that just don't like, no, you, that's not how it would happen, but isn't it hilarious? Mm-hmm. And everything in this episode feels pretty normal. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, okay. Husband and wife are having problems, done to death.
Yeah.
Husband decides to make up to her by taking her out for dinner and dancing, buying her flowers and candy, done to death. Yeah. Nothing new in that storyline.
Right.
Okay. Well, we're just doing that so we can have the babysitter bandit. Okay. Slightly more interesting. Babysitter robs people. Okay. And so she robs them too. Oh, okay. I saw that coming. And then the confusion at the end is that, as you might expect, if the kids aren't there and find the babysitter tied up and don't know anything else, they let her go. Uh-oh, the police came. And there's, you know, it's not elevated. It's not surprising. It's not absurd. It hasn't been exaggerated to some level that's making you, you know, laugh. It's everything feels pretty mundane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though on paper it's a decent story about the babysitter bandit, but it just doesn't do what The Simpsons does well, which is take things to another level. And that's why I'm glad I got a chance to watch the Christmas special, because in that one it does get ridiculous. He becomes Santa Claus, and then Bart sits on his lap, and then he has to like get Bart to stay silent. And and Bart's like, "Aw, you sank so low because you love us so much," which is the perfect, like, oh, he's being totally disrespectful, but he really sees why his dad's doing this. And then he goes to the racetrack, and it's a dog track, which is despicable, you know, and they don't try to hide that. It's like, okay, now we're getting ridiculous. Now we're getting exaggerated. Now it's fun. Whereas Some Enchanted Evening just never felt like that.
Yeah, they never really pushed that envelope at all in this one. And it's fine. I like it for what it is and how it exists, and I'm guessing they're in a position here where they don't really know what they're doing yet. They're taking shorts and turning them into full-fledged 20-minute episodes, that's hard. So, you know, it would take some time to sort of push that stuff through. It would take some time to become a voice of social satire in the way that they did and still do, I think.
It's easy for us to sit here 30 seasons later and say, well, when The Simpsons is good, it's this.
Yeah.
You should have known that before you made these 30 seasons. It's like at season one, they're like, I don't know, we got a family and they're dysfunctional. Let's try some stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So it's amazing that they found that pace and that magic as fast as they did, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree. Now, quick fun little note, Dr. Marvin Monroe, who's featured in this as a radio psychologist type, makes other appearances in the show. He's in a bunch of them. In fact, they have a family therapy session in, I don't know when this was, probably still season one.
But he's not always a radio guy, is
no,
he?
No. He's like a he's like a Dr. Phil type, except he's
right. Okay, that's why I recognize
him. Yeah, the radio thing was kind of a weird offshoot, but he is among three main characters in the story, and not main characters outside of the Simpsons family, but regulars who have passed away in the story. Now it's four. I think I remember this right. Someone in the chat can correct me if I'm wrong, but Dr. Marvin Monroe died in a story.
Mm-hmm.
Bleeding Gums Murphy, the sax player that Lisa idolized, he passed away in the story. Mm. Maude Simpson died because she got hit in the face with Homer's t-shirt launcher. Or no, Homer ducked when the t-shirt launcher was supposed to hit him and it hit her and she fell off the back of the stuff and died. And there's a whole other story about the actress and why she was leaving the show and why they did what they did. And then I want to say Mrs. Krabappel, they had her character pass away because the actress who played her was also on the Bob Newhart show. She passed away. She's actually in this episode. This is her here being the babysitter. Anyway, that's her.
Oh, that's Mrs. Krabappel's voice?
Yeah, that's
Mrs. Botts.
I can't think of her. I can't think of the actress's name. Gosh dang it. But anyway, she played Krabappel and some other characters.
Marcia Wallace.
There you go, Marcia Wallace. And she was fantastic as Bob Newhart's secretary on the Bob Newhart show. But she passed away. This is recently, just a few years ago. And I'm pretty sure that's how they laid that character to rest, but I can't remember for sure. The point is that it's interesting that the show, despite the fact that it's 30 years on, that's the one little bit of mortality they have about time passing, really. The rest of it is just Bart's permanently 11. Lisa is permanently 8. Homer is never older than 35 or whatever it is. If they were their real ages, Bart would be, what would he be now? Like 46 or something? Like some ridiculous age?
Yeah.
Homer would be pushing his 70s or in his 70s by now. Like, it gets a little nuts. They've had other characters die, or actors die. Yes, chat room, who points out Phil Hartman played a couple of characters in there and was fantastic in it. When he died, he did Troy McClure and who was the lawyer. I love the lawyer. His office was in an Orange Julius in the mall.
But those characters didn't die.
Those characters didn't die. They just stopped being on there. But I think that was just out of respect.
Mrs. Krabappel, they actually showed without dialogue a couple of times after Marsha Wallace died. And in The Man Who Grew Too Much, they showed Ned Flanders wearing a black armband and mourning Edna, and her portrait joined that of Maud.
Oh,
Ned's first wife.
Well, there you go then. So yeah, it's just those interesting little side notes, things I like about the show. They generally, though, they keep everybody. And this one, you mentioned Moe's Tavern was in it, and Moe has, excuse me, really dark hair for some reason. Don't know why. It's usually blue. And he's doing his phone gags and all that stuff. And then Barney, for some reason in this episode,
the phone gags, too. That is one part of Some Enchanted Evening. It's like, when I think of Bart Simpson, I think of those phone gags. Like, yeah. That is part of his, the iconic Bart Simpson in my head. And I had forgotten they were from this episode.
Yeah. And then in that scene, Barney, who would become a regular.
Yeah.
His hair is the same color as his face and body, weirdly. I don't know why I noticed this, but I did.
Yeah.
He has brown hair in the future. In this, it's the same yellow as his face, and it's really weird. So,
and he's Dan Castellaneta as well, right?
I think so. I'm pretty sure Barney is him. I know that Hank Azaria is Mo. And that's the other thing. There are voices in this that are not regular cast member voices, and that's also unusual. So there's that doctor, the guy selling the roses, or somebody else too. But they have these very matter of fact, like off the street. Probably one of the animators or creators could have been graining himself. I don't know. I didn't look those up. But later in the show, you would have your cast of like, here are the six voice actors that work on The Simpsons, and they do everybody, like across the board. You know, Castaneda does like, I don't know, 30 characters or something. Hank Azaria does maybe that many or more. Then once in a while you have somebody like Lisa, Nancy Cartwright. No, that's who plays Bart, isn't it? Who am I thinking of? Oh, shoot, my brain. Anyway, whoever.
Why don't you open the IMDb page?
Look, if you're telling
me, Lisa is done by Yeardley Smith.
That's who I met. And if you're telling me the internet's a great place to go for information, we're gonna have words.
Well, that's why I put the links in the rundown.
she did Lisa, and that's it. That's all she ever did. So they would pretty quickly establish this. Marge was herself and her two sisters, basically, and that's it. That's it today. That's the show today. They don't have guests. Well, they have guest stars, but they don't have people come in and try to be Barney.
Yeah, they'll have like Stephen Hawking come on or Bill Clinton, you know, like they'll have celebrity voices, but that's the exception. That's not the rule.
Could Bill Clinton come on there? That'd be something. I don't remember that. I know they had a fake Bill Clinton once or twice, but I don't know if it was the real guy or not.
No, maybe it was never the real one.
Greatest episode of this show ever. I just wanted to point this out because it's on my list, and I see on IMDb it also echoes it here. Season 8, episode 23, Homer's Enemy. This was the episode with Frank Grimes in it. And if you know what I'm talking about, you know it's your favorite already. It is a fantastic episode of The Simpsons and perhaps emblematic of why that show has the legacy that it does. Hell of a thing. Well, there you go. That's The Simpsons, Tom. If I could, I'd go watch it all, but nobody, well, the FXX chat, app has it.
Yeah,
I guess.
That's how I watched it. Yeah. I logged in with my PlayStation View account on the FXX Now X XX Triple X.
I have. Whoa, app. Really?
And you can watch it all with limited commercials. They basically, when it gets to a commercial break, the first time it'll definitely play you a commercial. The second time it might, and then the third time it usually skips it.
That's pretty good. That's better than nothing. I ended up watching it on I have the old DVDs for some of the seasons, and I watched it on there. My friend also has all of it on.
Wait, Ms. Botts was played by Penny Marshall.
Oh, wait, what? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I had that wrong then, didn't I? Really? Penny Marshall of like.
Yeah.
Laverne and Shirley fame.
Right. All right,
got that wrong. I could have sworn.
And there aren't that many other voices. Like you say, there's a few off the street. It's Paul Wilson plays the florist. June Foray does the babysitting service receptionist and the happy little elf. And Christopher Collins does the TV host. But everything else is all, at least credited here, is all the regulars.
And June Foray, hold on, has had a foray into other stuff, except IMDb is not going very fast. But I know her voice from, she plays Rocket J. Squirrel, but is it in the original? I can't
61
remember.
61 to 63, the Bullwinkle show, yeah.
She was, yeah, and I think she just passed away, she's 2017.
Easy and Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, she's in a great documentary called, I forgot the name of it, but she's passed away last year, 99 years old. That is that's a hell of a run right there.
100 years. Wow.
Yeah, not bad. You and I will be
practically
lucky.
But I know she was actually 99, but man, if she had lived like two more months, she would have been 100.
I know. That kind of bummed me out. Yeah. Sadder I get. The more we talk about it, sadder I get.
Now, once again, we have to realize that one of the voices you heard on this pilot was dead.
See? Actually, it's probably the only one I could point to. There might have been another. I don't know.
Yeah, we didn't get Phil Hartman in this one.
No,
I think
gosh,
we're safe on
dang it.
Else.
I was so sad about that. Look, I liked Phil Hartman for 1,000 reasons. He had his birthday recently, or would have had his birthday recently, and so brought it up again. Shares a birthday with my dad. But one of the most like memorable things was his time on The Simpsons. And when they announced Futurama, part of the big deal was, hey, he's going to play this character called Zap Brannigan. And I remember excited. And I think Billy West killed it. I'm not going to complain.
Oh, yeah, he did, but... It's such a Phil Hartman character.
It totally is. So pour one out for Phil Hartman. That whole deal sucked. All right. Well, on that happy note, what'd you pour out? What was that?
There was nothing in there.
Oh, all right. Tom poured out make-believe.
Just going through the motions.
I like it. Kind of like me all the time. Hey, last week you may have noticed that there was no legal geek in the post show. That will be fixed today. Scott was an idiot.
This is a regular segment on the show.
It is. I'm an idiot. I don't know. I've got to come up, and I have come up with a way of reminding myself to do it. It's just a workflow thing, and I forget. Mm-hmm. Too many shows, too many ways of putting stuff up, and I just forgot. So I'm fixing it today. That'll be in there. So huge thanks to Legal Geek. We'll talk about Activision and Bungie in a second. Next month's autopilot episode will be The Office. And you might say to yourself, ooh, which one? And the answer would be both.
Office. It's a special double episode.
That's right. That's next month here. We're going to do the British and the U.S. versions of The Office. If I close my eyes and you say, Scott, tell me what you picture if you hear British Office. All I picture in my head is Ricky Gervais doing that weird dance in front of all those people. And if I close my eyes and you say, Scott, think of the U.S. office, all I picture is Kevin and that giant thing of chili that he spills all over the office entry area.
I think of Pam and the greatest love story ever told.
I wish that's what I thought of, but I think of chili spillage.
Yeah, well, that's fair.
It's it's the most horrifying scene. It gives me anxiety. Anyway, we're going to watch both those pilots, see how they compare. And my memory is that the U.S. one was a little rough and also a little... pretty much just step for step the British pilot.
Well, that's one of the reasons I want to watch them both, because I want to compare just how closely they follow each other.
Yeah, so we're gonna do both.
Or how closely the U.S. follows the U.K.
Yeah, and I see the chat's making fun of my pronunciation of both. Both. I sometimes say both with an L. I know, not today.
I mean, we sat here and we're like, well, if we do The Office, should we do the U.K. or the U.S. version? And it came to me, why not Zoidberg?
That's good. I like it. So that's next month. Now, next week, for those who may be confused how this works, is an alternating week. We do our discussion week. We talk about all the nerd news and discuss it back and forth and have some fun and do that. So then we have our film festival. Then we have another nerd discussion week. And then we have autopilot. That's how the schedule works for those who maybe were a little confused. And perhaps I could put something on the website to that effect. Maybe I will. We don't have to talk about our film thing. We'll figure that out on our own. We've already said that before.
Oh, yeah. What is the next film thing in 2 weeks will be Doctor Strangelove.
Doctor Strangelove. He's Doctor Strange, love.
And you'll love him.
So that's all coming up soon right here on Current Geek. Before we go, Tom Merritt, anything you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, I'm very excited to update you on the Gallium audiobook. Now, obviously, the Gallium print book or ebook are already available. Big thanks to everybody who's checked those out. If you haven't yet left an Amazon review, please do that. That helps a lot. But the audiobook is done in its first edit. So now the only holdup to it getting published is me. I've got to go listen through to it and make sure that it's in good shape to go up. So I'd hoped to get it done by the end of September, but I didn't make it. However, it should be up definitely this month. So keep an ear out for that, because it's an audio.
I see what you did there. I like that. Don't forget, if you really like Current Geek, and many of you do, and there's a way for you to support it. You just head on over to patreon.com/currentgeek. It's really not hard. Type that in your browser of choice, head over there, and boom, you're in. We appreciate all the support from current listeners who are supporting us, and if you have any inclination towards doing that, please do. Again, that is patreon.com/currentgeek. It's going to do it for us. CurrentGeek.com is our website. CurrentGeek@gmail.com is our email address if you'd like to send in your feedback. And as always, our Reddit is CurrentGeek.reddit.com. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, and for all of you. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we review how Activision Bungie's Destiny video game has ended up on the cutting edge of U.S. patent law. A few years ago, a company called Worlds, Inc. obtained 3 patents on technology relating to computer-generated display of avatars in a virtual world. These patents have claims broad enough on their face to perhaps invoke infringement claims against some later-developed major video game titles, And indeed, Worlds has sued big game studios for such alleged patent infringement. One such lawsuit was against Activision for the Call of Duty series in 2012. Later in that lawsuit in 2014, Worlds amended their lawsuit to add the Destiny game as another potential infringement. Destiny has been published by Activision, but is developed by a different company, Bungie. So Bungie was then brought into the patent infringement case as a co-defendant. In response, Bungie filed challenges to the validity of the Worlds patents in the then-new Patent Office review procedure called Inter-Parties Review. As a reminder, Inter-Parties Review, or IPR, was created in 2013 to allow for validity challenges to patents to be brought in front of an appeals board at the Patent Office, in a much cheaper and quicker process than fighting over patent validity in federal court. So this was one of the early cases to go to an IPR, and the IPR resulted in all three Worlds patents being invalidated. In other words, Bungie avoided the infringement lawsuit by proving the patents were improperly granted in the IPR process at the Patent Office. However, that has not been the end of the story. One of the rules established for the IPR process is that a patent challenger must file for the IPR review within a year of the challenger, or a related real party in interest, is served with a complaint alleging patent infringement of those same patents. This time bar was put into place to avoid having patent litigants fight out the validity in court, and then go back at a late stage in the litigation to fight over the same issues in the IPR process. An alleged patent infringer must pick one or the other: challenge validity in the court case, or in an IPR. The reason this rule is invoked here is because Activision and Bungie had a publishing and development agreement in place for Destiny back when Activision was originally sued for patent infringement by Worlds in 2012. That is more than 1 year before Bungie and Destiny were added to the lawsuit, and thus also more than 1 year before Bungie challenged the patents in the IPR process. So Worlds is arguing that this business deal makes Bungie and Activision a related entity, and the one-year time limit had passed before this party filed the petition for IPR, making it time-barred. This argument has made it all the way to the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, which overruled a lower court's ruling against this argument from Worlds about the time bar earlier this month. While that doesn't mean that Worlds will eventually prevail and eliminate the result of the IPR against their patents, it does mean the lower court will have a close call of facts to consider in this case. While it seems a little unfair for Bungie to be added to a lawsuit so late, and then told it cannot challenge the patents in an IPR because of the late addition to the lawsuit, the involvement of Activision in both games, and being alleged of infringement, makes a good case for the patent owner. I don't envy the court in having to decide this gray area issue on what seemed like a simple and straightforward time bar rule for the IPR process. The bottom line is, highly successful game developers are often targets for patent and other IP infringement actions, thanks to software patents being on the cutting edge of current decisions of what is patentable in the US. This also means some of your favorite companies are setting the course for how new patent laws and procedures will be implemented going forward. We will keep you updated on what happens in this case, although the patents may very well be invalidated in court by Activision and Bungie, even if the IPR result is thrown out in this process. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.